Pete Seeger, How Can I Keep From Singing?
It's very possible that I would not have been a musician. I would just save music to be something to have fun with. And I could have been very happy as a forest ranger or a newspaper reporter. I really wanted to be a newspaper reporter.
That's the voice of Pete Seeger, perhaps the most controversial musician in American history. Yet more than anyone, Seeger has kept America singing by reminding us of our shared musical past. He's taught old songs to millions and shaped our country's national repertoire. I'm David Dunaway, author of How Can I Keep From Singing? The Ballad of Pete Seeger. This is the first of three programs on Seeger's work and on the folk music revivals he helped start. We'll hear from the Seeger family, Arlo and Woody Guthrie, Judy Collins, the Weavers, and many others. Pete Seeger became the first musician in American history to be formally investigated for insurrection. What made him and his music so dangerous? The answer begins long before the FBI began chasing after folk singers. Back in 1919, when Constance Seeger gave birth to her third child in New York City. Here, in a 1976 recording, he recalls his upbringing.
I was born into a very easy life in many ways. My parents were professional musicians, and when they split up, I went and spent my vacations with my grandparents, who had a lovely private house in the country. I didn't live in an ivory tower, but I lived in a woodland tower. I loved to go out hiking, and I actually knew so little about the world, it's funny. I mean, I was a babe in the wood. I knew all about plants and animals and could identify birds and snakes. I didn't even know that anti-Semitism existed. I didn't know what a Jew was until I was about 14 years old. My contact with black people was literally zero. My grandparents were very conservative, Republican, respectable people. I remember at age 6 seeing a cartoon in a newspaper, a fellow with a beard and a bomb in his hand. And I said, "Who's that?" He said, "Oh, that's a Bolshevik. He wants to blow up everything."
My family was not connected with any of the very famous names of colonial New England.
Dr. Charles Seeger.
They were more or less middle class, businessmen, preachers, teachers, and that sort of thing, who didn't attain great wealth. There, I think, you'd find a rather healthy descent coming right down from the Puritan descent in England and the reason for the colonization of New England.
My father's convinced that great classical music was going to save the human race. After graduating from Harvard with very high marks in music, he met the president of the University of California, who was impressed by this very self-confident young man. He was appointed to build up a music department. His fellow professors radicalized him, though. One of them took him out to the lettuce fields in the valley, and he saw little kids that could have been his own children working for pennies out there. Came back and made a speech. "This is disgraceful that such things should be happening in America." But when World War I came, he made speeches against imperialist war and got fired. My mother said, "Can't you keep your mouth shut? You're not going to be drafted."
Pete Seeger's father was the first person to teach ethnomusicology, or folk music, at an American college. Pete's mother was a violinist at the Juilliard School of Music. But like many a six-year-old, Pete found practicing at the piano or violin unexciting. Instead, he'd strum on the auto harp or ukulele. Note that many of these interviews and recordings are more than a half century old.
Whistles, almost anything that made music, I banged on. I didn't want to study it. I was just having fun.
There had to be a different story every evening. Well, you know the story of the frog song. That was a particularly favorite one.
I usually tell people, half jokingly, that I became a communist at age 7. And they said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I read every book by Ernest Thompson Seton that I could get. And he held up the American Indians as role models. They shared whatever they had. If there was food, everybody in the tribe ate. I found some congenial people among the students, and I didn't bother with the others. And they were learning to smoke, and they were listening to jazz and organizing dances. I didn't have money to go to any of those things. As a very immature, very naive, rather bookish kid, I did probably better than normal in Avon because I ran the newsletter. You know, the first year there, I shined shoes to try and get a little more allowance. In 1929, the crash came. My father's convinced that, well, this is the end of the free enterprise system. And instead of just joining the socialists, he joined the communists, who were among the bravest and most active. He needed a job. He tried teaching at the new school. There he met Thomas Hart Benton, who liked to, every Saturday night, invited friends. One of them was Jackson Pollock, and they'd sit around playing John Henry and other songs. When I was on vacation, I sat in with them. First time I ever heard John Henry.
John Henry was a little baby sitting on his papa's knee. And he picked up a hammer and a little piece of steel, cried, a hammer's gonna be the death of me, Lord, Lord. Hammer's gonna be the death of me. Cried, a hammer's gonna be the death of me. Hammer's gonna be the death of me. Now the captain, he said to John Henry, I'm gonna bring that steam drill around. I'm gonna bring that steam drill out on the job. I'm gonna whop that steel on down, down, down. Whop that steel on down. I'm gonna whop that steel on. I'm gonna whop that steel on. John Henry told his captain, Lord, a man ain't nothing but a man. But before I'd let your steam drill beat me down, I would die with a hammer in my hand. I would die with a hammer in my hand. I would die with a hammer in my hand. I would die with a hammer in my hand.